This is the third in a series of interviews with Dr. Kenneth Olden about his tenure as director of the National Institute of Environmental Health Sciences. The interviewer is Victoria Harden. The date is February 10th, 2005, and the interview is taking place in the offices of NIEHS in Bethesda, Building 31. Dr. Olden, we were beginning to discuss, you and Sarah Shostak at the last interview, a number of the scientific fields that you had looked into. One of the things that you did as a first was to demonstrate that one can prevent organ-specific metastasis of malignant cells by blocking the specific interaction between fibronectin and the integrin receptor. Okay, could you describe for me the significance of this discovery for efforts to prevent metastases in cancer patients?
Yes. The lethal feature of cancer is not so much the growth and proliferation. It's not the localized tumor. The thing that kills the patient is, in most cases, there are a few cases where the primary tumor is the cause. If it's deeply embedded in the brain, for example, it's inoperable or you can't do it, get to it. But in most cases, it's the spread of the disease that, which is called metastasis, that is the cause of death. Because once the cancer spreads to different parts of the body, the only source of eradication you're left with is chemotherapy or biological therapy or in some cases, basically, I would say chemotherapy, biological therapy. Radiation therapy and surgery are very effective in removing or eradicating a primary tumor. But so if we could prevent or cure or treat metastatic disease, we could in fact prevent death from cancer. So it's a huge, would have a huge impact on the mortality from cancer if we could just treat metastatic diseases. Now there are a lot of approaches that are being used to do that. Just this week, two days ago, I heard a presentation by a fellow who's targeting angiogenesis, the new metastatic foci when tumors spread, when they reach a distant organ, in order for them to grow into a new tumor, a new cancer at a distant in another organ system, they have to develop a vascular blood supply. And there are efforts by Judith Folkman and many others to prevent the vascularization of these tumors. And so that is one approach. Our approach, of course, is if you could prevent the tumor cells from attaching to the foreign tissue and penetrating the foreign tissue, and by using inhibitors that block adhesion molecules, you could in hopefully do that. And that's what we demonstrated that you can do in an animal model. Turns out that we were blocking interaction with one protein, and there are multiple proteins that cells can adhere to, bind to. And so when you knock out one, they'll circumvent using an alternate binding mechanism. So now I'm still looking at that, but what I'm trying to do is find a sentinel event that's required for all the adhesive interactions. In other words, a critical intersection. And if I can identify what's involved in molecules or involved in those critical intersections, then maybe we can then block adhesion to multiple molecules. Wow. And really reduce the efficiency of metastasis. So it's a very exciting area of research, and we've been on the end of looking to add adhesion to the foreign tissue and penetration of foreign tissue, but there are other strategies that are being used, but all of it is aimed at preventing death from cancer. Mm-hmm. And so the public health impact would be enormous when we're able to do that. And with time, we're going to be able to do that.
Would you tell us a bit about your research on the anti-cancer drug Swainsonine?
Swainsonine. Yes. Again, earlier work by us and others had demonstrated that there are surface carbohydrates, are sugar groups on the surface of cells. And these sugar groups are bound to proteins. And they are bound to the protein that we work with. We work with an adhesive protein called fibronectin. Fibronectin, it turns out, has five side chains. You know, the backbone of the protein is this way. And along the backbone, there are five side chains of protein, of carbohydrates. And those carbohydrate groups have a lot of individual residues of sugar that are strung together in chains. And we and others recognized that it was a unique structure of the carbohydrate group that was required for as part of the recognition. In other words, how did the tumor cell recognize the target organ? How did they recognize platelets and other cells that are required for adhesion and recognition? And we demonstrated that if you could use a drug like Swainsonine and you could modify the surface, the sugar, the composite, the structure of the sugar side chain. So we altered the structure of the sugar side chains so that you block or prevent recognition. So tumor cells, rather, once they're carried by the blood vascular system, say from the breast or lung to a distant organ, they would not attached to that foreign organ, or they would not recognize other cells that were required for them to aggregate. And so you could treat animals or cells with Swainsonine, and eventually we would administer it to the animal, and you could prevent metastasis.
Okay, so this is the drug then that did what you were describing
right before.
That I didn't realize that it was, but I see what you're saying now.
No, it is not. It is a different drug.
It's a different drug.
Yeah, so there's two ways to block metastasis. There are specific proteins on the surface that bind to specific receptors. The first agent that we used was an amino acid. It was a pentapeptide. And we used that pentapeptide that would bind to the receptor, preventing the receptor then, it would mask, block the receptor. So cells then that had the cell surface mass could not then bind to anything else because it was already, the binding had already taken place, but with a little short peptide. And so that was one way. So you could block metastasis by using a little peptide. But we also discovered that you could change the surface, the carbohydrate side chains, on the protein fibronectin. And that would also prevent recognition. And that would prevent metastasis as well. So there's two ways of, in fact, there's a prevented, or more than that. But those were two that we used.
Okay, and that would then help to explain also how you're moving forward in other directions
right, on
the same
problem. Right.
All right, now.
Now, Swainsonine is now being looked at by the National Cancer Institute still, I understand. And the problem with Swainsonine is it's toxic. There's a lot of toxicity associated with it, turns out. And so efforts are being made to encapsulate, put Swainsonine in something to deliver it to the tumor site where you want it to go, and then release it. And so those efforts are still underway, and if you can overcome the toxicity of Swainsonine may still work.
All right, now let me follow up on that a bit. To deliver it to the tumor site, Is this a biological delivery system or an instrumental?
It's a biological.
What kind of?
Right. Well, I gather they're encapsulated in liposomes. These are lipid-soluble vesicles. Mm-hmm. You just put it in a little, and lipid-soluble vesicles can penetrate, just go right through the membranes, because membranes are phospholipids or lipids. And so there's not a solubility problem. So you add it outside in the bloodstream, for example. When it gets carried to the tumor cells, it can penetrate and get into the cells.
And you can put a monoclonal antibody on it or something that'll take it directly to that tumor and nowhere else?
You could do that, although that is not the way they're, yes. I mean, that is, they use monoclonal antibodies to carry and deliver drugs.
Mm-hmm.
This is not the approach they're using here.
What are
they? Absolutely. Well, they're called lipid vesicles.
Okay.
And you just take a solution of lipid, which is the way they're created. You take a solution of lipids, and lipids, you see it as a solution, but in fact, they exist as little vesicles. And if you mix up, say, Swainsonine with this lipid mixture at the right concentration and lipid ratio, these little vesicles form. And when they form, they entrap the drug. And then if you can deliver that drug.
And how do you do that?
Well, they just put it into the bloodstream, and it will go a lot of places, but it should have no effect probably any other place, but it will get into the tumor.
It will get into the tumor.
Tumor, right. So that is the problem, specificity. Antibodies are specific.
Yeah.
Lipid delivery system, vesicle delivery system are not specific. So let's say if it gets into a brain cell, of course there's the brain barrier, you don't have to worry about that. But let's say it gets into a liver cell or a kidney cell, or will it cause a problem? And so that's still
being explored.
Explored.
Yeah, good. Right. Thank you very much for elucidating that for me. Now, in all of this, obviously, you have been the principal investigator of the metastasis group,
right,
of the laboratory,
right,
molecular carcinogenesis,
right,
even as you served as director.
Right. Right.
How did you find the time?
Well, I made a decision when I left the National Cancer Institute in 1980, I guess, and went to Howard University as scientific director first, and then ultimately becoming director. I made the decision that I really got into science because I like doing science, and that I always wanted to be able to do science. And it's hard to be out of science for 10 years and then go back. So I made a commitment to myself that if I could do the administrative and fundraising and other things that were required and do my science, I would continue to run an institute. But if I discovered that my science was, I was going to be unable to do my science, I was going to give up the administrative part and go back and do science full time. Turns out that, so I just made a commitment to do that. And also, I felt that if you're running a scientific organization, you need to be a scientist, because you need to be respected by your colleagues. And I found that to be true. So I just make, you make time for the things that are important to you. And so this week, I guess yesterday or day before, I met with the head of my laboratory. He and I meet once a week for an hour and a half. And we talk about what everybody's doing in the laboratory. So he manages the laboratory for me on a day-to-day basis. He's a staff scientist, and we talk about what everybody's doing. We talk about we discuss manuscripts that we're writing, and then I meet with him once a week, and then once a week I meet with the whole group in a room like this, a conference room, and we go over the science, and I hear that and have feedback as let's do this, let's do that, and keep up. And so now that's better. It's not ideal. But it's better than, I think, than not being active in science at all. Now, just this week, when we met with my the person who runs the lab is a staff scientist. I learned that a paper that we just submitted 2 weeks ago had been provisionally accepted for publication in the Journal of Biological Chemistry, which is the best journal in our field, either Journal of Biological Chemistry or Cancer Research. And I like to get them in either one. This project was one that was more biochemistry, although it is with breast cancer cells, and it is cancer. I mean, it's part of the project. But we got it accepted, and that was good news for me. But you see, when I meet with my scientists then, or they see that the director of the institute is publishing papers in good journals, and we had a meeting this week about the intramural budget. And you know, this year it's going to be pretty tough. We're going to have a lot of money. And so the decision that I make, with the scientific director about how much money does the intramural research program get, affects me as well. So I can meet with the lab chiefs and say, guys, look, we're gonna have a lot of money this year. We're gonna have to, it's gonna be a difficult 2 years, and we're gonna have to do the following things. But I'm in the same boat you are.
I would like to explore this just a little further, because I think this is something, I don't know if it's common in science everywhere or just in the government, but I know, for example, Dr. Fauci has his lab,
right.
He is a director, and Dr. Collins has his lab, and you can see how someone who is outside of science would say, well, the director's lab is going to get special privileges,
right.
And they would never have to worry about money,
right.
Compared to the others, because that's the way a lot of the world works. Would you like to elaborate on how that works?
Well, the system at NIH is a good one. My laboratory is in the National Cancer Institute. So it's not in my...
It is
in Research Triangle Park, but administratively it's in the National Cancer Institute.
Now that's different.
And I hope the other institute laboratories are also not in their institute for it. Right. Now, so my laboratory is reviewed by the Board of Scientific Counselors in the National Cancer Institute. And they decide whether my work's good enough to be funded and at what level. Now, so they advise Michael Gottesman, who's the scientific director. Ken Olden's lab is, let's say, good enough. His productivity has been fine. He's doing good science. And he asked for this amount of money, and we recommend that he gets this or that or whatever. It turned out they concurred with me that the amount of money that we had was adequate, and that I should be given the amount of money that I requested. Now, once that decision is made, though, is my institute. My money comes out of my institute's budget. But the decision about whether I get any or any is outside.
I think yours is different from some.
Right.
That's very interesting to know.
So I don't. So when I was thinking about stepping down as when I announced that I'm stepping down as director. One of the things that was is where do I want to be full time? Do I want everything to be at NCI, although keep staying in North Carolina? And people said to me, well, you can switch back into the institute because you have passed peer review like everybody else. So nobody can claim that just because you've been director that we're treating you with favoritism, because you're funded for 4 to 5 years already. I mean, NCI said that. I mean, the Board of Scientific Counselors. So 4 to 5 years, we'll forget that you've been director, and you have no influence over the decision that what happens to me 4 years from today, scientifically, in the institute, I suspect nobody will give a blank that I was director for a number of years. Either my science is good to deserve continued funding, or it won't be. So I make sure that I don't want people to say that I'm treated differently or that I fund my own lab, and so I want to go through the same peer review process as everybody else. And I think otherwise you won't have credibility. And so while I want credibility by continuing to do science, I want credibility also by going through the peer review process like everybody else. And I feel good about that. I mean, I can tell you, it was so hard carving out the time to prepare myself so that I could make an intelligent presentation and make a case for my money, that I thought, well, maybe, Ken, you should just give it up and close your lab down. But I didn't do that, and I got through. I made the presentation, it was a good presentation, and I got funded.
I think this is an ongoing discussion about whether administrators can manage to squeeze it all in. I mean, Michael Gottesman himself has his lab, and that was an early tradition at NIH before World War II, but for a good while afterwards, with Dr. Shannon and others, they didn't even try.
Didn't try, no.
But it's interesting that it's coming back around, and many of you are.
That's right, and I still think that it's better. I think we've hired some of our extramural people who run the extramural research program, or their program officers, and we've given, I hired one explicitly to and gave him a laboratory. And I wanted him to be a hybrid. I wanted him to kind of be over evaluation. How do we evaluate our science? How do we know we're making important contributions? And I wanted him to, so we created a new office. Now that person needed to be nested in the extramural part, because that's where most of our money is. And so he could get the cooperation and support and access. But at the same time, I wanted this person to really be a scientist. And I didn't want him or her to lose their enthusiasm and knowledge of science over the years. So we put him in the intramural research program and the extramural. So he has a leg in each one. And he has been able to do his job in administratively. But at the same time, he's been able to be competitive and survive Board of Scientific Counselors review. And I said, having been in a university, this is no different than a university faculty who has to teach, they have to write grants, and they have to do quality research. So we're asking him, rather than, so we brought him from a university, you no longer have to teach, you no longer have to write grants, but you do have to do something beyond the laboratory part. And so we gave him a laboratory set up, and rather in lieu of teaching and grant writing and other committees that he would be on in the university, he has to give me information about what are we doing that's really important in the institute scientifically. So I think it's not only important for administrators, I think it's important for others as well, because if you're away from science for 10 years, most people, now it's not, there are exceptions, but most people lose their enthusiasm for it. And their knowledge is not always the most current. Because science, if you practice science, you're forced to remain current, or otherwise your research won't be competitive. I mean.
All right. Here's one of these final wrap-up questions. When you were headed down to NIEHS and decided to move down there, I would be interested in hearing sort of an overview of what intrigued you scientifically about its program, because its intramural program had been described rather derisively as NCI South. And you had been a part of NCI North,
so you obviously
had a sense about what you hoped to see in similarities and differences between the two institutes.
Right.
Will you
right.
comment on that?
I was a bit concerned because clearly our institute was not going to be highly visible and perceived as being successful as long as we existed in the shadow of a big institution like NCI. So the question was, how could we live up to our mandate to look at the role of the environment in the development of cancer, and at the same time create a separate image for ourselves in addressing other diseases as well as cancer. So I was concerned, and I think the issue was that I guess the Institute was established because of public concern about the impact of the environment in terms of cancer. And somehow we had never kind of moved much beyond that. Now, we always had a mandate within our mission to do anything else and address any other disease like Alzheimer's, Parkinson's. But all that you heard about from our Institute was cancer. Well, when members of Congress think of cancer, they think of NCI. They don't think of us. But now, so I felt that the issue was the areas of emphasis we needed to be expanded, but we also needed a different message. We need to communicate. We needed communication strategy to get us visibility. So I created spent a lot of time with people who are experts in communication to help us craft what is now everybody calls a brand for ourselves. So I wanted to brand NIEHS as being part of the NIH, important to the mission of the NIH, but had different from NCI. So we created this, what we call a mantra, this triangle, that said human diseases are caused by genetics, environment, and behavior. And we began to push that. It's caused by the interaction between. And this morning, Alan Spiegel presented at the Institute Directors Meeting some science. And up there was a slide from NIEHS dealing with this gene-environment interaction part. And so we had to, so it was had most to do with communication. But also the agenda was too narrow. So I expanded the agenda to, and so on walking over from the Institute Directors Meeting, I walked over with a fellow director from mental health, and he wanted to talk to me about autism. Well, 12 years ago, or 13 years ago, autism wouldn't have been on our radar screen. But autism is now on our radar screen, and he wanted to talk about some work that we're supporting at Columbia University and at University of California, Davis. So we're on the radar screen for lots of things now. Autism, Parkinson's, Alzheimer's, osteoporosis, breast cancer, so we're a player. But it had to do with diversifying the portfolio and a communication strategy, branding.
Well, also the fact that the Institute was just beginning during the Great War on Cancer years,
right,
may have also had, yeah, an impact on focusing on cancer,
right,
and you had the great,
right,
opportunity to,
right,
to do the diversification.
Right, right, right.
As we're coming to the end of our conversations here, I want you to be able to explore anything that you think of that we haven't covered. Let me just say that in 1996 you wrote an editorial on the occasion of the 30th anniversary of the Institute in which you discussed challenges. I wondered if that would give you a framework to go into the things that you are proudest of, the things that you really would like people to remember as far as your directorship. You spoke about three things, and let me just, I'll read them to you one at a time and let you comment,
yeah,
if you
right,
will.
Right.
First, teasing apart the genetic causes of disease to help discover genes modulated by the environment, and you want to...
Right. Well, yes, that's one of the developments that I'm most proud of, and the one that I think I will... That's the major part of my legacy, is that I created what we call the Environmental Genome Project, which is kind of like the Human Genome Project, except that the Human Genome Project was trying to determine the sequence of the alphabets and of the letters in the alphabets for the whole human genome. And we're going back and say which, and that, and what they identified was called a reference sequence. It's the average for the American population. But I know, we know that there is dramatic variation among individuals, among groups. So the genetic code is, while we're 99.9% identical, we're 0.1% different. And 0.1% of a big number is a lot. Mm-hmm. And so now we're going back and saying, of those genes that we know that are involved in causing environmental diseases, how many of those have what we know and call polymorphisms, or variations? And are those variations responsible for the enhanced acceptability of populations, of individuals? I mean, why is it some people who smoke don't never develop lung cancer and others do? And or people who consume too much alcohol or whatever don't develop kidney disease and cancer? So a lot of these things have to do with genetics acceptability. And that's what we were talking about, autism. One of our investigators at Columbia University discovered that she administered a mercury derivative called thimerosal that's in vaccines to something like 5 different strains of mice. Now mice are inbred, so, but the strains are strain differences, kind of like differences in humans. And she discovered that one of the strains was susceptible to thimerosal. In other words, it developed phenotype, behavior, and so forth, similar to autistic children. The other 4 did not. And so she concluded that, you know, based on a limited study, that this suggests that it is indeed the genetic background that determines whether you develop autism, a kid develops autism, when exposed to thimerosal. Now we're having that study repeated. So what we went after is to try to understand, why is it that some people are susceptible to environmental exposures and others are not? And we suspect that most diseases are the direct consequence of the interaction between a susceptibility gene and the environmental trigger. And that's where everybody is, that's where NIH is now. But we started that in 1997. And in order to tease apart, that's the point. If you want to know how genes and environmental agents interact, you need to know both. You need to know what is the genetic risk factor, which gene, which variation, and which environmental agent does that gene interact with. And the only way you can do that is most straightforward is the approach that we took. And now NIH, human genome, and everybody's looking for susceptibility genes, because that's where the excitement's going to be. And so we were out front on it. We got a lot of good press. Won the Nobel Prize laureate Lee Hartwell wrote an article about our environmental genome project in Nature. A young woman who's a writer, a journalist for Science, wrote one about it. And so there's been a Nature article, 2 Nature articles. So we got a lot of credibility for that. So that we're doing that now. It's certainly not finished. So that the new director is his own work is in that area. So it's something that will be continued for a number of years. But I would say in 5 to 10 years, we're going to have lots and lots of data to begin to figure out how to prevent and identify which populations are susceptible, and we can either decide what sort of action to take public in terms of public policy. So I'm very proud of that.
With good cause. The second point you made was understanding carcinogenesis of environmental agents, and you've talked a lot about that already. Is there anything else that you'd like to add to that?
The approach turns out that we don't have a good methodology for identifying carcinogens. So I created a program in 2000 called Toxicogenomics Approach. And it is a high-throughput approach to identifying which agents are carcinogenic, which agents in the environment or drugs are carcinogenic and which ones are not. And it's a gene and protein expression profiling procedure. And it's a way of looking at thousands of genes and thousands of proteins at the same time. And so that's how it gets to be high throughput. Right now it takes us about 5 years, a cost of about $2 to $6 million, and about 1,800 animals to identify a single carcinogen. Well, I think using toxicogenomics approach, gene protein expression approach, you can do this probably in a matter of weeks, and that's what we hope, at a nominal cost, and maybe with no animals or one or two animals. So that's going to be, so what we're doing is, using toxicogenomics, is developing approaches that are fast and cheap and use fewer animals and in the end are more informative than our current tests. And so that is going full swing. We have six university-wide centers, base centers, that are toxicogenomic centers, and we're investing millions of dollars to generate those profiles, our fingerprints, so that we can identify a carcinogen. And in the end, we hope to do it exactly the way the FBI does when you, is a fingerprint. So we are going to put in a signature in a database someplace, and any chemical that has that signature, you know, will be a carcinogen. And you can make a prediction very fast. FBI can do it in 1 or 2 days, or well, I guess they can do it as soon as you can send it in through a computer. They can get a computer match.
That's what we
plan to do, is pick out offending environmental agents in a matter of a day, because it's in the database. So so I'm happy about that. And that again is I gather that the March issue of Environmental Health Perspective is put. Apparently, the editor asked different people to tell them what they think my legacy is and write a little one-pager or whatever on it. And toxicogenomics is one of those that they asked somebody to write on. And it will be interesting, but, they asked to write about the Environmental Genome Project. And so it will be interesting. It's a very interesting concept. So I guess there will be a special issue with the areas that they think I've developed and that's my legacy.
I know about this issue, and I think it will be a fine issue to have. It's also interesting,
right,
however, just to hear it from your own mouth, what you think. And that brings us then to the last two points, which are really a part of the same. One is animal models, using animal models, and the other is developing new ones.
Absolutely. That's exactly right. I, like many other people, abhor the use of animals in medical research. Although, obviously, I recognize, like a lot of other people, that there is no alternatives. Either you let people die from devastating illnesses, or we make some effort to find cures, and we need animal models. So I use them. But to the extent that we can, I am eager to find alternatives. And now we can create alternative, and we can make animals more sensitive, so that you don't have to use 800. Maybe you could use 5. And I'm not sure in my lifetime that we'll ever get to the point that we don't need an animal, but we may not need 800 per chemical. And so I am concerned about the number of animals that use. I want them to be experiences to be more humane, and so the only way you can do that is develop alternatives. And we're invested in toxicogenomics is an alternative, because I think you can do it with just tissue from an animal, and not the animal, and you don't need the animal anymore. And I think there are also ways to make the animals more sensitive, and so you don't need the same number. You only need, and you, because they're reliable, they're genetically manipulated to be susceptible to this or that. And so you don't need, reasonably use 800, because there's so much variation from animal to animal, and we don't know what the genes are. But if we knew what the genes were, and we could actually create an animal model with that gene variation or whatever, and then everyone that you expose to, let's say, to a carcinogen in cigarette smoke would develop cancer, so you don't have the statistical problem. Mm-hmm. So we are doing that. We've made a huge investment in developing alternatives to animals, not just through toxicogenomics, but through creating, genetic, manipulating the gene, the chromosomes, the genes in the genome of the mouse, and still using a whole mouse, but many fewer. But they're called transgenic animal models. That's what I was trying to think of.
Right.
So we've created transgenic animal models that are far more useful and informative in carcinogenicity or toxicity testing than the typical rodent model.
We've covered a lot of area in these three and a fourth interview that Sara did with you also. And I know it's hard to remember back over all these months, but I wonder if there's anything that you think of that we haven't talked about that you would like to get on the record.
Well, we've talked about it, but it is one that still I think we don't do very well at the NIH, and I'd like to come back to it.
All right.
Because it was discussed this morning at the Institute Rector's meeting again, in a way of information. And I didn't speak up because, this was the EEO thing about how do we, you know, we have a mandate that we're going to, you know, get minorities and women, I think, and into the NIH, and women not only in, but promoted up through the ranks. Now, for women, I think it's whatever the issue is, issues, barriers are, they're removable. We can do something about that, because women are trained. They are just as good as the men who show up. And why is it that they don't become institute directors or lab chiefs or Title 42s or SESs? There's a barrier, and we can identify those barriers, and we can remove them. But they had African American scientists up there, and the presenter, I guess, presented as if the barriers are the same, and they aren't. The problem with African American scientists is a pipeline, and no matter how hard you or I try, we can't find enough people out there with the training, qualifications, and experience to populate NIH the way we'd like to see it populated. In other words, people who are competitive for the jobs that are announced here. And it has nothing to do with my interest or willingness of the NIH to do it. And so we keep, going out there with advertisements and calling people. And pardon me, it ain't ever going to work until we have a pipeline that every time you advertise that 10% or 15% of the applicants are well-qualified African Americans. So
what can you do about this? And from your position, as I know you've been very concerned about this and very active in it,
right.
Specifically, what do you hope you have
well,
been able to
Well, I'm going to write the person made the presentation in an email and sends their own carbon copy of it. And that is, it's the pipeline issue. And just last week I was in Puerto Rico, and I'm going to tell Dr. Zerhoni about that. There are two programs in the United States that's really having an impact on the pipeline. Now it's just, in my case, I think there are others who make incremental contributions, but two programs are really successful. And we, many years ago, I bought into one of them as soon as I heard about it, and I think that was in more than 10 years ago. And the other, so that one's at University of Maryland called the Meyerhoff Program. It's at the University of Maryland, Baltimore campus, and they don't have a graduate program. They're training minorities and low-income others, other from other groups, who are not represented in science, and they're providing them with an environment in undergraduate school so that they can first become excited about science, but also go on to graduate professional school and come out and become practicing scientists and competitive. And they've been successful at doing that. So I have been giving them $500,000 every year, and now back then we were up to $650,000 or $700,000 now. We started out $500,000 a year. And we do it through the National Science Foundation partnership. And now we have a track record. Well, I was just in Puerto Rico and discovered that that program, though, which was created by NSF, not by NIH, and is phasing out. It was a 10-year program. It's been in place 10 years. And now it's phasing out as of next year. Well, NIH, we have not been part of it. I mean, NIH hasn't. We have been. NIEHS has been. But the other institutes. And we keep supporting this program and that program. And you say, in the end, what are we getting for it? And so I'd like to see us just step back and say, I mean, it's going to take a while. I mean, that's just be... This liberal approach won't get us there. Let's just step back and admit what the issue is, that there are not enough black scientists that are well-trained in the best institution that are going to be competitive in NIH. So how do we get them? Let's take the long haul look and say, if we invest in programs like Meyerhoff and the MEI program at Mendez University in San Juan, Puerto Rico, we are one day going to have this population. We're going to populate the field. Now, you're going to be criticized by, black colleges and universities, but they want some of the money to run their programs. But they've been running their programs, and it hasn't worked. So, if until we can get African American going to Stanford, Yale, and Harvard, and Princeton, like everybody else, going through those programs, come into the NIH through 4 to 5 year postdoctoral training program, and then go out there and compete like everybody else, we're never going to solve this problem. But you make people happy and the noise goes away if you contribute, if you support a program at Morehouse College or Meharry or wherever, Howard. You don't hear a lot of noise. But our problem is not solved, and we aren't solving the problem of the African American community. Now there's...
Wait, let me ask you the question on tape here. I talked with Dr. Kirstein about women and why more of them had not followed in her footsteps as the first woman to be a director of an institute. And she said she was somewhat disappointed that there weren't more. And I'd like you to comment on the same thing with respect to African American scientists.
Like Dr. Kirstein, I too am very disappointed. But I want to say I don't blame the system. I think there's very little that we can do at this point except to try to restock the pipeline. And I think that while the efforts that has been made in federal government to get more African Americans into science, we are expecting somebody else to do the pipeline issue. And we want them as they are coming out. Well, nobody's going to come out unless somebody goes in.
That's right.
And you've got to find good programs that are going to create the kind of person that we're going to, and I maintain that most of the...
Is it good enough to do it at the college level, or do you need to drop back to high school or elementary school?
It would be nice to go all the way. But it's already been demonstrated. I mean, Meyerhoff program, now they pick and choose. They you've got to have ability. So they try to identify innate ability and drive. And basically what they do is take kids who in the top 10% of their class, wherever they've been, at least that says something about a kid. He or she has taken advantage of the environment which he or she has been in. And then they bring them in, and they kind of herd them all together. And there is, kids learn from each other, and they acquire a lifestyle that's very different from the other cohort of kids. And so they've been very successful. We now have one of their fellow in our institute. And this is a woman who went through Meyerhoff here at the University of Maryland. She went to Georgia Tech and got a PhD in engineering, and she is in imaging. She's a and she's now a postdoc with us, and she works jointly with a person at NIEHS and a professor at Duke. This woman's very good. She came and gave a seminar, very poised, knows what she's doing, and NIH was very happy to get her. Now, this woman, we didn't have to make exceptions for her. And my guess is she's motivated enough, she's smart enough, well-trained enough, that if she can, she will be somebody that will go up through the ranks someplace, if not NIH, and be a full professor. So it can be done. And that's what Meyerhoff has demonstrated. Now, in Puerto Rico, they've demonstrated the same thing. I was just down there, and there was a young woman there were other examples, but I'll cite this one. She went to MIT. She worked with the National Academy of Science person. We funded her program at MIT. They've got her, and she got her PhD. They brought her back to Puerto Rico at the Mendez University, and she's got, it's just amazing. The equipment, the lab, the enthusiasm, the quality of the undergraduate education at that institution. Now, Mendez University admits it has open admissions. They take any kid, and they try to, again, identify those characteristics. And these are not the best kids don't go there. I mean, supposedly, the upper middle class,
right.
Economic. Don't go there. These are the kids who probably wouldn't be going to college at all by their own admission. But they take these kids and they turn them into real stars. And I've talked and interacted with, in a room like this, at least five of those stars.
Sounds exactly like the City University of New York taking
in... Yeah, in the old days.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
So
right.
In that sense, what really is needed is perseverance and just hanging in there with the programs.
Right. And getting students excited about science and understanding what the lifestyle is. I think that if you're interested in science, you like science, then it's not work. It's you're doing what you enjoy doing. So I just think, I'm going to say to Zeroni and all, that until we make a long-term conscious investment in the pipeline, we're never going to have these people. Now, he could say, well, I will be here 10 years from now. Why should I? And I understand that. Or I could say, I'm not going to be here. But I've made investments for 10 years, and this is the first one of the postdocs, or first two, that I could even compete for. So I've said to both Meyerhoff, I'd like you to tell me every one of your students that is out there so I can write them, stay in touch with them, at least offer them a position when they get out. Now, they don't have to come to NIEHS, but since we've been part of their, and I know these people are well-trained, and I did it because I want to increase the pipeline for us and others, I at least want to call them up and say, look, we have a position here, would you consider it? And let them come down and look at it and make the decision. But the point is, whether they come to NIEHS, NCI, Heart, Lung, and Blood, or University of Maryland, these people are going to be well-trained and can be, and that's how it's going to happen. It's not going to happen the other way.
All right, well, as we end, you obviously are far too animated and interested in various things in life to just go sit in a rocking chair. So what are you planning to do for the next 30 years?
Well, I'm going to write and lecture at probably some of the historical black colleges and universities. And I want to do that because I think I have had experiences and training that could be very important for students to kind of understand and get acquainted with somebody like me, I think. And few of them have asked me to do that. And let's say, Wright and I just wrote an article that we hope that Science Magazine, we think, is going to publish, and it's on healthcare. And this is an issue that I care about, and I'm I am challenging attacking the healthcare delivery system. And I think we've done, I read what I hope is the final version of the plane last night, but I think it makes a compelling case that we're never going to solve this issue of health disparities. You know, we have a way in this country is just, you know, working at things around the fringes, and when in fact it's the infrastructure is the problem. And infrastructure is difficult to change, but you got to start someplace. And in fact, I gave a talk to the President's Cancer Advisory Panel, and I made that case. And the very day I gave the talk, turns out, I came back, got on the plane, opened up USA Today, and they had a cartoon that I now have that said, health care, it compared health care with Social Security. And Social Security is broken. Now you can improve it, and that's what they showed. They showed President Bush putting curtains around Social Security. But behind the president was this two windows broken, and health and care was at the top. You could see it. And so this is the opinion of many people, that health care is indeed broken. But Social Security is not. So we need, and we're running out of time with health care. And we have the best science, we have the best trained people, we have the best research in the world, but yet we rank number 37 in terms of our healthcare delivery. And why is it so? There is a disconnect. And so that's what I am discussing. Why is there that disconnect? And until we address that disconnect, and just yesterday I finished the article because I incorporated another paragraph, because the president just came out with an agenda that 2 or 3 days ago, and it fell on my desk and I looked at it, and he's talking about health care, and exactly what he said is exactly what I've got in my article. So I conclude by pointing out that this is absolutely consistent with the president's agenda on health care, and quoted him, which is exactly what I said above. But he's not focusing on the infrastructure, and he's not going to get there. So things like this, I have time, hopefully now, to really think about some of these big picture issues, and that's what I said. What we need here is leadership, somebody who's visible enough, and so I'm sure I could get this written in, I want it to come out in Science, and I will reach one audience, and we think that they are going to do it. But there is another audience, and I'm not sure, but at least if it gets out there in the press, it will get debated, and it starts the debate. And so that's, and I can tell you, I didn't get into New York to testify before the President's Cancer Advisory Panel, but I sent my testimony because they are putting together a white paper and everybody's testimony. Well, a woman that I don't know from New York wrote to me after she was there in the audience because it was a panel was meeting in New York City, and when the weekend they had the big snow. She wrote to me and said, "Dear Dr. Olin, I read your statement that you submitted to the President's Cancer Advisory Panel. You know, they handed them all out, even though I was unable to get there in person. And I can say that I heard all the others, and you're the only one that really proposed anything that remotely is relevant or interesting." She said, "Most of the others were just whining. And you came and said, let's do something different and important." And she's the woman who's interested in breast cancer. And she said, "I was very impressed with what you said. You emphasized prevention, health promotion, as a way to bring down health care costs and changing the system. And it was," she said, "it was compelling, and I applaud you." Now, I don't know this woman. I had a platform, I used it. So that's what I want to do, is use the platform that I have to try to focus attention on some of these important issues. And in part, I couldn't say or do because then I'm an institute director. But once I'm no longer an institute director, I can say, for example, that continuing invested in historical black colleges and universities the way the NIH has done over the years, it's not going to solve the problem. And then they can't, you know, we won't, they can't call up Zirhoni and say, one of your institute directors. So I'm doing it as a private citizen. I can't say that.
Right.
And it needs to be said. It needs to be said by an African American.
Right.
And if you think about it, we've had all this time. Ruth is certainly one of the at the forefront of creating the minority program. But she has to be disciplined with what the product, the return. It just hasn't worked. But I would say on the women's issues, you know, I think there's 5 women institute directors now. And that's good.
That's coming along. Yes.
That's coming along.
Indeed.
Now, it was a long time in coming. But and the reason that there are 5 is because there are lots of women out there who qualified to be directors of, and just needed a director of the NIH who would pick them.
So if you extrapolate that, you have just a fewer relative to all women,
right.
African-American,
right.
Males and females,
right. Right.
But you do have the Ken Doldens and the Colin Powells and the Condoleezza Rices who have reached a level, but there's the pipeline.
Yeah, there are so few that Duke wants wine and Harvard wants wine. And when everybody has, you know, we all want to live in different parts of the world, we want to do different things, and you scatter us all around. There just isn't enough to go around.
Right.
I mean, you can imagine, people write to me all the time, universities, because they think, you know, I'm black, they think I know others. And I just nominated a fellow for the chancellor, they're looking for a chancellor of the University of Tennessee, Memphis Medical Center. And I nominated a young black guy, and they just called me on Saturday, and I was driving, pulling in a parking space, and I get a phone call. And they called me and say, look, Ken, you nominate somebody, and boy, he's good. He is one of the final 2 or 3 for the position. And that's what they appointed. I mean, I don't think that they don't want to select an African-American, but typically there wasn't going to be one in the pool.
That's right, or come up on the radar screen.
So I nominated this fellow, and they said, you know, this guy, he is very good, whether he gets it or not still. And I think it's an open, fair process. Mm-hmm. And I'll just tell you this. I'm a Tennessean. I applied for the position, that's the reason they called me about the position. I applied for the position of the president of the entire wide system. And again, I was a finalist. Mm-hmm. And I think it had nothing whatsoever to do with the fact that I didn't get it, that I was black.
Mm-hmm.
They were impressed that I was qualified, how I handled myself in the interviews, and I made friends, and gained their respect, and again, just one person knew me and wrote to me and said, "Look, I hear you're stepping down as institute director. Would you consider this?" And I did, and it went through the long, drawn out process. But in the end, when they ranked the people, there's no way you could say that I wasn't qualified to do the job. It was just a matter of my going down and convincing them that I could do the job. And they were convinced of that. But in the end, I had never run a university. And the person who got it was vice chancellor or provost at University of Wisconsin. Not Wisconsin, Connecticut. And he had run a university on a day-to-day basis, and I hadn't. And the question was, somebody had to make that
right,
decision.
Sure.
And it was a ballot. And then there was my age. The guy's 10 years younger than I am, and that's an issue. So it is an issue. And so you take all these things, and I think they made a good choice. I think times have changed to the point that if you're qualified, you can, in most cases, not all, you can get through the door, for women or minorities. I mean, there are some people who obviously wouldn't hire me because I'm a minority, and wouldn't hire you because you're a woman. But I think that's passing. But my going down had some real importance, because now they know me, they respect me, and they respect anybody that I nominate. So I nominated, there were, you know, 30 or so people, and they went through the process and narrowed it down to 2 or 3, and there were some outstanding applicants. because I looked at it. And this fellow is one of the aspirin advocates. So those are the kinds of things I'm going to try to.
Well, I thank you very much for talking with us. And when we do the editing, you certainly should feel free to add anything else that comes to mind.
All right. And thank you very much. I appreciate your interest.